Welcome to the Financial Markets Insights podcast brought to you by the Realization Group, where we bring together the best minds in the financial and capital markets industry to discuss all the latest trends and news. Our podcast host for today is Jan Apache, and our guest speaker is Peter Laurie, CEO of Chronicle Software. In this episode, Jana and Peter will be discussing the IKEA effect, a fascinating phenomenon whereby consumers place a sometimes disproportionately higher value on things that they have either made themselves or to which they have contributed towards making. They'll be discussing how this relates to trading technology and asking how the IKEA effect could translate into building great trading applications.
The IKEA effect is a fascinating phenomenon whereby consumers place a sometimes disproportionately higher value on things that they have either made themselves or to which they've contributed towards making. This can have a significant influence on perceived value, to the extent that people might value imperfect things they've helped create more than they would value the equivalent perfect but ready-made product. Those who have pained memories of tussling with Allen keys and occasionally incomprehensible schematics for self-assembly furniture will no doubt have raised eyebrows. Of course, the effect only applies to items that are successfully assembled. If people fail to build an item using the instructions provided, or it takes too long or is too difficult, due either to the complexity of the instructions or the inexperience of the user, then they do not ascribe the same value to the item. According to researchers, there are a number of possible reasons for this effect. There's the obvious investment of time and effort, which leads people to incorporate the value of their labor into the finished item. For the more creative types, or those seeking a more customized solution, there's also the value of personalization and of meeting their bespoke individual requirements. However, what's interesting is that some research has shown that the IKEA effect can apply even when no customization is involved, and where the customer has only followed fairly simple and straightforward instructions in assembling an item. The theory is that participation in the construction and assembly process fulfills a deep-rooted need for self-efficacy. That is, people derive satisfaction from the feeling that they are able to influence their surroundings, for example, by creating objects. There is an apocryphal tale associated with an early iteration of the IKEA effect, having its origin long before the advent of IKEA. When the first instant cake mixes were produced in the 1950s, they required nothing more than the addition of water before mixing and baking, and they were not particularly popular. In desperation, the manufacturer turned to a psychologist for help, and they suggested that the problem lay in the simplicity of the cake mix. It was undermining the value of the cake baker's role in the process. Make it more complicated, he suggested, and they will flock to it. So the recipe was amended to remove dried egg powder, and instant cake mixes began to require the addition of fresh eggs. And sure enough, they began flying off the shelves. Of course, it's entirely possible that this was primarily driven by a consumer preference for cakes made with fresh eggs over then mysterious ingredients such as dried egg powder, but it does illustrate the power of the IKEA effect. At this stage, you'd be forgiven for asking yourself the question, well, this is all very interesting, but why is a trading technology company interested in the IKEA effect and instant cake mix? Well, it's because of our reaction when we first found out about it. We realized that a lot of what companies like us do leverages and builds on the same psychological factors behind the IKEA effect. Of course, they're not asking clients to self-assemble a trading system out of components provided in a box, given a few schematics and an Allen key. But nor are they delivering a full and perfect product to which clients have had no input other than picking it off the shelf. Key to this philosophy is that clients enter a partnership that's about customization and ownership, particularly when addressing challenges faced by trading firms contemplating the question of build versus buy. The client needs to be supported to define, implement, and test firm-specific customizations using a framework that can be tailored to their needs. The solution needs to provide all the components necessary for failover, high availability, performance, and scalability, so that developers need only focus on those pieces that solve the business problem and take trading performance to the next level. Key also is a focus on knowledge transfer to collaborate with client teams, embedding best practices, and ways of working, and giving development teams a safe environment in which to be creative in producing the best business solutions. This is a partnership that focuses on enabling development teams to realise their capabilities and creative potential. The philosophy extends to ensuring by the end of an integration project that clients should need very little, if anything, from the trading technology companies, because they will know how to maintain and adapt the system themselves. Firms like Chronicle's business model does not rely on being indispensable, but instead it is about scaling up and expanding to address new markets in a fast-paced and increasingly digital landscape, and building that next cupboard. So Peter, welcome and thank you for joining us today. Some really interesting concepts that we've touched on here, and looking forward to diving a bit more deeply into that with you today.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting concept because we see it applicable not just in software, but it's just a feature of human nature, I believe.
Okay, but before we get started on the IKEA effect, can you tell us a little bit more about trading technology, which is an area you've worked in for many years now, and what are the kind of unique requirements of trading technology that can make it a little bit more distinct and make it a little bit more unique than from other types of financial software applications?
Well, a lot of people's experience of software is using it from a user interface, like a web interface or an application. And this is true in financial services as well. So if you use a retail online application for banking, or even if you're a trader and if you're trading UIs, your experience of software is through a user interface. And that's to be expected. That's its purpose. However, when it comes to implementing back-end services, you've got constraints and requirements on your software which are quite different, because you've got automated systems talking to other automated systems. And particularly in trading, latency is much more key. Different systems have different latency requirements, but they will all have latency requirements which are generally much faster than you would see from a UI. Because there's no point a UI updating much faster than a human can see. But from a trading perspective, you want to update fast as a computer can process, which is a different kind of criteria. And so then you can get things like volumes, such as higher throughputs or lower latency requirements than you can actually see. So you may either have higher throughputs, like you're dealing with volumes that no human could possibly make sense of or ingest. They can only get some sort of condensed report, or maybe your throughput's not so high, but your latencies are so low that you can't visually see whether your latencies are fast enough, because you care about latencies that are too fast to see. So both of these require you to have additional tooling around your software to tell you whether it's performing as needed. You can't just see whether it's performing as needed like you can with a web interface. You actually need additional tooling to both visualize, monitor, but also investigate when you've got latency or throughput issues.
Okay. And I guess also what makes trading technology a little bit more sensitive is the fact that for many trading firms, their business, their USP basically rests on their trading strategy. And so therefore there's a great deal of proprietary knowledge that's wrapped up in their trading strategy and how that's implemented in practice. And that leads to the build versus buy conundrum, doesn't it? So do we buy something off the shelf that can be customized, but perhaps might be fairly limited in the degree of customization that's involved, and also may have support issues down the line if it's too heavily customized? Or do you build something from scratch, and that's a huge upfront investment, but nevertheless can deliver more bespoke outcomes? Is there a middle ground that can deliver the benefits of customization while also leveraging the benefits of what's available off the shelf, or are those just two completely different worlds?
So one of the problems that clients also see from vendor solutions is that they're exposing any strategies they have to the vendor. So even if the vendor isn't necessarily looking at it, they often require some of their involvement in terms of implementing those strategies, particularly if they're novel. This discourages investment in, say, trying to develop any kind of secret sauce, because you know from the start you have some exposure, like that keeping that secret sauce to yourself and not making it available to other clients of that vendor or even the vendor themselves is difficult right from the start. So then you don't invest in that area because it's questionable if it's as valuable. So one of the benefits of doing at least an important portion in-house, particularly your strategies, is that you do have something that's yours that you do control. And so then you can feel like there is a point in investing in it and developing something that's novel or unique to your business or to your traders, because you have control over, you know, where it's used and who has access to it, more control. So from a business perspective, there's more inclination to invest in a custom solution or one that you have complete control over. Then the question is, well, do you develop everything from scratch? Is there really any point in doing that? And generally the answer is no, because so much of the system is going to be just the same as every other trading system. You're not trying to reinvent how trading works in general, just certain parts of it, the strategies, the bits that add the most value. The rest of it can be quite generic. And so that's where you get the benefits of build versus buy. So if you start with a solution that essentially works and it's been used in other banks for many years and it's stable, then on top of that, you can build your own strategies. You're not giving away any access to the IP because you're running the software on your systems and you've got complete control over it. So you get the benefit of having something more or less pre-built, but not the disadvantages of being reluctant to invest in developing unique strategies because you're concerned about exposure.
Okay, so now I think we're getting to the link between the IKEA effect and trading technology, right? So how can the IKEA effect in practice translate to building great trading applications?
So it goes back to more ownership in the component which is unique to you. Like what are you trying to do that's different or customized? I talked a bit about the being able to control who accesses it, but also that the people working on the project, assuming the project is developed in a reasonable time frame, so like 6 months to 12 months, then they're going to continue working on that and they're going to be personally invested in it because they helped assemble it and put it together and put all the finishing touches on it and maybe put some of their unique propositions into the project. This is also one of the advantages of something that's between build versus buy. If you do it all from scratch, there's a risk that the project will blow out into years, like 3 years or longer. And by that point, by the time it goes into production, a lot of the people that worked on it will be ready to move on to something else or quite sick of it. So you lose a lot of the advantage of building it yourself from scratch, if you do it from scratch. Whereas if you build something that gets to market in a reasonable time frame, you're going to be more invested, you're going to be more willing to work on it and put take more ownership of the system. So you're more likely to want to make it a success. And so you get benefits from the productivity of the team as well.
Okay. And this is, I think, something really interesting that you're touching on, that building software is not just about the actual application development. It's about the people involved and how they're going to behave, not only in the short term, but in the longer term that you're relying on them, and how to create a more appealing environment all around to retain those people. And I know this is going a little off piece, but I also know it's an area that you've been really interested in for a number of years, and actually looking at that kind of behavioral aspect of developers and what they're interested in, and how to build applications and software and a product that works for the people as well as just in terms of the technology. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about how you became interested in that area? Because that's ultimately what led you to kind of start applying these ideas behind the IKEA effect in practice, I think.
So one of the things we realized is that for a successful application, one that's not cancelled or fails, for a successful application, over the life of the application, more money is spent on it after it goes live than before it went live. And more resources and investment goes into it afterwards. And that's to be expected, because you know, you have something successful, you want to make the most of it. And so that's the sort of projects that we want to be working on. We aim for projects that are going to be successful. And on that assumption, we want to make software that's not only easy to develop, but also easy to maintain. We want it to be, so we focus on, well, how will this be to use it in reality? And this partly comes from the fact that our libraries we've been supporting for about 8 years now. So we've not only developed the libraries, but we've had to support them. And we've seen our clients have to support them as well. So we've got many clients who have been around for many years. So we've been through the exercise of not only developing the software from scratch, but we're also heavily involved with our clients after it goes live and after it's been running for many years, and seeing how we ensure that the software is still very productive, very easy to develop in, and developers still want to be working on those projects so that they're retained and that knowledge isn't lost and moved off to some other project necessarily.
So what are some of the practical applications of the IKEA effect that you do, that you apply to your software in order to increase that ownership and in order to create that ability to retain expertise and interest?
So what we go for is what we consider a custom feel rather than completely customized. So we have many components that can be assembled in a variety of ways, but that's going to be difficult to start with. So we start with something that essentially works and can use it out of the box with very little configuration. But it's with the expectation that as people get more familiar, they will realize, oh, well, this is an area that we actually want to customize quite heavily. And we build our applications, our libraries in such a way that they can be easily extended with plugins, and whole portions of it can be replaced with their own implementation over time as it suits them to do so. And certainly for our larger clients, they also get access to the source code. So even if they've used something that's based on what we're doing, they can see our source and take advantage of patches and updates that we do to our own software.
Okay. And is there ever a case for building, for going to either of the extremes, for either building completely from scratch or buying completely off the shelf? Have you ever seen scenarios with clients where actually, given the nature of their organization and what they need and want, it would be best for them to either build or buy?
Yeah, so what we try to do is to provide the components that most trading systems just need again and again and again. And so we build something that's quite established and works very well, and it's well documented. However, depending on where you see your providing value, it may be in the raw technology. It may be that you're trying to do something completely different at the lowest level of the technology, in which case, then you have to build everything from scratch. You may be building the OS from scratch yourself. You may be doing custom hardware, building your own FPGAs. And at that level, you're starting to have to really do everything yourself. And certainly for some hedge funds, that's their value proposition, is just being faster than anybody else. However, for most banks and hedge funds, they want to be fast enough, more than fast enough. They're not looking to be in this competitive arms race all the time. Most of their value really, certainly for banks, really comes from their clients and managing the relationships with clients. But they want their backend systems to still be efficient, but not necessarily that's their key value proposition. Because that's a very difficult thing to maintain, because you can be the fastest for however many months and someone comes along and they're faster and you lose your entire business model overnight. And a lot of banks don't like going down that road in the first place. They would much prefer a value proposition which has got some sustainability. Certainly things like, you know, having a good client base, and then just executing on those clients' demand efficiently, it's a much more sustainable model.
Okay.
On the flip side, many companies will just go to a vendor, and that makes a lot of sense when the volumes you're dealing with don't really justify building an in-house solution, or you're not looking to have some competitive advantage in the software. That's not the game you're looking to play. You're perhaps you're not dealing with enough volume, or that you're really just focused on your clients, or you're in a somewhat secondary area. So, for example, maybe your main asset is not FX. So how you deal with FX might be a relatively small part of the business. So you don't need to develop your own custom FX system. It makes more sense to just use something that's already available and working off the shelf. Maybe go to more than one vendor and they provide all your FX. The efficiency might not be quite the same, but you're not dealing with enough volume that it matters.
What about the risk that things might change and that the software or parts of it will become out of date or obsolete if I'm going for, you know, that kind of middle ground approach, that hybrid and best of both worlds approach? Is that something to be concerned about?
Yeah, certainly in the strategies that is the case, that they need to be maintained. Depending on the sensitivity of your strategies, they might only be good for a few weeks or a few months, but that's kind of a business decision. From an IT perspective, we focus on components that are very generic. They're not even specific to fintech. That's our biggest client base, but they're used in telcos and biomedical and a lot of other industries, gaming, for example. So even if the fundamental nature of fintech changes dramatically, they would still be useful. Like I said, it would be one of our biggest users outside of telcos and gaming, which is quite a different industry, really.
And I guess on the flip side of that, you know, the risk that things might change, is there also potential for the introduction of greater innovations? So introducing frontier technologies such as cloud, AI and DLT through this approach, can this approach help firms to more quickly adopt these new technologies if, for example, they're not directly having to build the connectivity or the interfaces that enable these technologies to be leveraged? Instead, they can rely on some off-the-shelf components and then the application of those components is what is proprietary to them.
Yeah, so in terms of time to market, where we get the most positive feedback is around our testing methodology. So we've got a pretty robust behavior-driven development testing methodology that's designed to support low latency systems, but can also just make it easy to produce new functionality and have it tested and reliably deployed. And certainly one of the strongest feedbacks we get is from the business is how quickly they the development team can turn around new functionality and have it work the first time. And that's one of the best keys to innovation is to have an application you've got good velocity of development even after it goes into production. You're not terrified of changing anything because you don't know what it's going to break. Instead, you've got a good testing methodology so that you can be confident that new functionality works and it hasn't broken any existing functionality.
Okay. And this approach to trading tech, you've explained how it works and why it works well for the client, but what makes it work well for Chronicle as an organization? And what experiences have you had in the past with the other approaches that led you to go down this path?
Yeah, so we've worked on, previously I've worked on quite a lot of projects where they had certain challenges. And in general, the biggest challenge is around technical debt. So I've often get involved when there were performance issues. But a lot of the fundamental reason there were performance issues was due to accumulated technical debt within the application over time, where there's just so many things that are not quite right or ideal about the application that it's slowing down development. It's not only slowing down development, it's also slowing down things such as performance tuning or identifying any kind of performance problems. And that's something they can measure. You can't always measure technical debt, right? Because developers might say, well, this is hard to develop, but that can just sound like the developer's complaining. But if the system's slow and you can measure that, then okay, well, you can point to a number and say, this is something that actually needs to be fixed. So often I would get involved in consulting engagements that were extensively for performance issues. And indeed, there were performance issues, but the more fundamental problem was that there was too much accumulated technical debt in this application that was in production. And so a lot of the techniques that we look at is ways of making sure that that technical debt doesn't just accumulate and become overwhelming. So we focus very much on low latency microservices, so that individual components in the system can be easily rewritten or replaced without having to re-engineer your entire system. We focus on good testing behaviors so that you can introduce new functionality or again, replace a component and make sure that it does everything the previous component did very easily. And so it's really about managing this technical debt, which generally you only see once the application's been running for a few years. So that's a big problem I see in the industry is that a lot of developers, particularly contractors, will work on the development of software, but by the time it's gone into production, they've probably moved on to something else. And then they've moved on to something else and something else. So they never see what is the challenges in actually maintaining and running these systems years later. They see a system that's just is in such a state that there's not much you can do about it. You just have to plod on. So what we try and do is solve in our software, we solve hard problems from the start, things like solving high availability, low latency performance, testability, and velocity, maintaining velocity of development long after it's gone into production. Those are the sorts of issues we try and deal with right at the start so that by the time, so when you do the development, there's a bit of a learning curve on how to use all of that. But once you've got that, you know that going into production and post-production, it runs so much smoother. And if anything, it's a bit of an anticlimax. So that's our goal. So when you go into UAT and production, it's no big deal.
So delivery is the anticlimax. That's an interesting take on it. But
sometimes boring is good.
Sometimes boring is good. You don't want the day that your trading system goes live to be exciting for the wrong reasons, do you?
Exactly.
Would you be able to give an example, just a short example, of where this has worked really well for you in working with a client, and where you've really been able to deliver value by being able to work with them in this way and apply these principles?
Yeah, so we had a client in Singapore recently, and one of the concerns that we had based on our previous experience was ensuring that the client could get up to speed quickly enough to deliver. And in their case, they wanted to go into UAT after 5 months. And so we knew it was possible because we'd done this with other clients before, but we wanted to make sure that it would go into production without any particular drama. And we provided the training up front, and we provided far less consulting than we would have done in the past. And yet, within about 2 to 3 months into a 5 month project, they really had it covered. The project, there wasn't anything that they needed from us. They just needed to get on with it, and they did. And it went into UAT after 5 months. And this is a client that there was. Was the first bank that was willing to publicly say that they were using our product, which was really exciting for us. But it's also partly down to the fact that the rollout went so smoothly from when they started to when it went live, that really all the interaction with us was largely at the very start. And by the time it went live, we didn't really need to, they didn't really need our involvement very much. And that's a good sign that we were skilling them up, both that the software worked and did everything they needed it to, but also that we'd skilled them up sufficiently right at the start, and they could just get on with it. And that's our aim, is that they shouldn't really need us except when there's something quite peculiar happening, right? Most of the time, they should be able to service themselves and do everything themselves. And that's our aim, to skill up our clients and to train them up so that they can run these systems themselves.
And that is a very different model to how clients are accustomed to being treated by their software vendors, I think. We've just got a few minutes left. So what's the future for Chronicle, Peter? Where do you see the company going? What are your new areas of interest? What areas are you expanding into? Be great to hear more.
Yeah, so in the past, as a company, one of the biggest shifts is that we've relied quite heavily on a small number of big clients, tier one banks, and each year we get one or two new big clients, and we have a number of smaller ones. And we've really shifted more recently towards getting more smaller clients, and that's good for us. It's just a more sustainable model commercially, and so we're excited about that. It also gives us it makes it easier for us to plan longer term, so we have more developers in our team. And I'm very pleased about that. From a technology point of view, one of the things that we're seeing is obviously our products being stretched in different directions, being used in ways that clients previously haven't used them. So in particular, we've got one client that's looking to deal with about 6 terabytes of data in a very short time frame. But with trading latencies as well. And obviously there's no hardware that can do that just all in memory. So we're having to look at ways of processing that extremely efficiently without necessarily having as much hardware as you might want to throw at it. So that's kind of exciting because it shifts it more to being a software solution because we're a software company. It's unfortunately the case that actually most problems in software can be solved by just throwing more hardware at it, the problem. And often hardware is cheaper than a developer. So those problems aren't so interesting to us. So having some clients out there that will actually throwing more hardware at it just wouldn't solve it. We need to be clever in terms of how we deal with it in software. They're the ones that excite me.
Thanks, Peter. And I think, you know, you've had one of the more fascinating things about Chronicle as a company is that you have tackled some of these really interesting software problems in the past, but that's probably one for a whole separate podcast in the future for probably a slightly different audience as well. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
It's been great talking to you.
Yes, very good.
Thanks to all our listeners for joining us. You've been listening to the monthly Financial Markets Insights podcast hosted by Jana Pache. Subscribe to the podcast to stay informed of all our future shows, or you can sign up for our newsletter to get all the latest updates from The Realization Group at TheRealizationGroup, realizationgroup.com. See you next time for more Financial Markets Insights.